Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven on WNHH FM, New Haven's home for community radio. I'm Paul Bass, your host, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Oh, that's right, today's Dateline Hamden. And we have a 26-year-old Hamden native who is one of three candidates on the ballot on September 14th in a Democratic primary for mayor. Say good morning to Peter Sear, who is one of three Democrats, as I mentioned, running for mayor this year in Hamden on the ballot. Peter, welcome to the studio. So nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Stoked to be here.
Great. You might want to move your mic a little closer because you were close enough when you talk, but you don't have to get whiplash during the whole time we're talking. We had a nice time chatting before we went on the air. It's really a pleasure to meet you. And obviously, everyone's noticing that this really young guy is running for mayor for the biggest office in Hamden. So how's it going so far? You had a candidate forum last night. I guess you're not going to have debates, but you had a forum. What's it been like being up there with people who've been in the political scene longer? Well, you've been in politics, but, you know, elected office. And what was it like being the young guy up there?
It was good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Connect. I thought they had good questions.
That's the coalition of congregations, religious congregations, and activist group that sponsored the event last night. We'll have a story about that in the Independent later today.
Yeah, and I would actually like to have a debate. I've requested from both candidates a more formal setting that's less about commitments.
And we usually host those debates. I had to admit that I felt there might not be a lot of, and I don't like twisting people's arms, and I thought there might be arm twisting involved. Usually people come to us and beg us to host debates.
You know? I would love if you guys wanted to do one. Anytime, any place. I'm open. Okay. Do it.
Well, we'll talk today. So, like, why do you want to be the mayor? You're 26. Why did you leapfrog ahead of being a council member, maybe a state legislator? Why do you want to be the mayor of the city, and why do you feel like you're ready to be the mayor of a city facing major challenges with over 60,000 people?
Yeah, I think we have a comprehensive platform that has been built talking to Hamden Democrats. I think it's reasonable. I think it's attainable. And, you know, I don't think I skipped the council part. I just think the council has been incredibly toxic, unproductive situation. I think the change has to come from the top.
They spent hours arguing about stuff that's not on the agenda about how you're going to fix broken financing and policing of the city.
That's simplifying it. I think we could be a little more efficient in our conversations, right? Not get bogged down bringing national stuff locally. So for me, I think the change does have to start from the top, and that's why I'm going for mayor. I'm dead set on mayor just because I think we need to lay out a better process for our town. I think not being tied to the administration or any of the past decisions is a huge advantage for me. And I could come to this race with sort of a clearer head and perspective. I haven't alienated anyone. I've tried not to. I've tried to keep this focused on the issues. So I think that's a unique perspective for our town, and it's something that our town is looking for.
And so you're also running a big government. Like, how big is the budget?
It's $260 million, about that.
So what's the biggest budget you've been in charge of so far in your life?
Probably around, for our field campaign, like $500,000.
So in other words, you've run budgets and had to tell people where to go to carry out stuff in a political setting. Because, I think what gets underappreciated sometimes with jobs like mayor, especially in an era in global warming, climate change, because you have to deal every year what used to be once in a decade or once in a two-decade major storms. And there's an asterisk in Hamden, which is that it's jinxed. Whether it was the 89 tornado or any other storm, it seems like if an area has a big storm passing through, it almost always wallops Hamden the hardest, like the Snowmageddon in 2013 when you had 34 inches of snow. What about the non-ideological, even non-issue sometimes points? I mean, there are always issues about how best to spend resources, but just running a town, why do you feel you're up for that challenge?
I love Hamden. I grew up here. I think Hamden's a great place. And I want to get back to a positive narrative for our town. Mm-hmm. I know what people value in our town. I know that our town is incredibly diverse. I know that we value that diversity. And I think we've just gotten away from the things that make us care about our town. We need to get back to those things that bring us together. And you know, I think a lot of it has been tied to national politics too, whether it be Trump or what have you. And it's been divisive. I look a lot of it as social media too. We lean a lot into social media in Hamden, and I think that doesn't always portray the images that we want to. So again, it's about a less toxic approach. It's about setting up a better process that is good for Hamden residents and is not focused on personalities.
And that's really interesting you say that, because there was this given that I think we don't accept as given anymore, which is Tip O'Neill's famous saying, all politics is local. Mm-hmm. It's starting to feel like all politics is national. Like, I don't know if you follow the mayor of Sacramento, California, who was it Sacramento or a different city? No, not Sacramento, California. Stockton. Mm-hmm. This rising star, Michael Tubbs, he was great. And then this, like, group of Trump QAnon people started a fake news site that made up things he never did that were supposed to be horrible because he was a young black man. And everyone believed it in town and voted him out and had nothing to do with all these big changes happening in Stockton. And here, as you mentioned, in Hamden, you know, and I think this is a good thing that the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016 activated a lot of people to be involved locally. They say, if we care about these think globally issues, we want to act locally. Mm-hmm. But do you think there's a danger sometimes when that very good incentive to care about your world, beginning your hometown based on a set of larger values, can sometimes lead people to try to cut and paste?
Yes.
National positions or ideas of good guys and bad guys, friends and foes, onto issues that might not quite fit. Like, I'm thinking about New Haven. We had an incredible one organizing done to get rid of a skate park for black kids in a park, where a lefty Black Lives Matter organizer united with a few white people left who didn't want black kids skating a park and called it an anti-gentrification issue.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that what you're seeing happening in Hamden?
Yeah. And you know, I look at issues, local issues, and I don't think they really apply nationally. Like housing, like, you know, it's a very local issue and it knows no party. So I think it's about talking to people in the neighborhoods and getting a feel of what the neighborhoods are like and what they feel about an issue, and then trying to find common ground and uniting all of Hamden. Right.
Okay. So there's no question everyone would agree with you have local issues don't always fit into national, but people would say there are national forces that are very important.
Yeah.
So are local forces. So for instance, when jobs left our region, those were because of high highways were built and electricity was done and incentives given to company and union busting. What about housing? When you look at housing, Hamden is starting in southern Hamden to see some of what's happened in New Haven, where low-income housing that might have, in a previous generation when there were more factory jobs, were owned by the factory worker with a multifamily that's rented out to someone else, or an apartment complex owned by a local person who owns a few. Now they're being bought up by these conglomerates that are with a lot of out-of-state and out-of-country money, millions of dollars a year, tens of millions in New Haven, buying up Section 8 properties and run down. The money's not going back into investing it. Isn't that a national issue, or gentrification, or not?
So I look at the issue more as Westwoods and Spring Glen have not allowed for housing in their neighborhoods.
Are you talking about zoning?
Yes. I look at it as a zoning issue, which is extremely local. You know, and that has stifled growth in our town. Spring Glen and Westwoods, we don't use the land as efficiently as we could.
Are you talking about density multifamily housing?
Yeah. I think it applies to segregation in our town. It also applies to economic growth. We've stifled our growth by having exclusionary zoning. And if you look at specifically in Spring Glen, the 2009 commercial overlay is the restrictive zoning barrier in that town. And that pretty much prevents you from putting a multi-use property in
a place. I'm sorry, what year was that?
2009.
Okay.
It pretty much prevents you from putting a multi-use building next to a place like Walgreens in Spring Glen, if you're familiar. So that, to me, when you look at what is constructed, really what they're trying to prevent is a big high-rise. And that's not what I'm actually advocating for. I'm actually advocating for modest housing that mixes residential and commercial spaces.
So mixed use. And that's a different issue about, like, coming out of urban renewal in the mid-20th century when they said that this idea that you have one kind of thing, housing in one place, and then commercial in another place, industrial in another,
correct,
that at least with the first two, you want to mix them together.
Yes.
So that was just sort of an error in planning. But then there's also the segregation aspect, which is that if they feel there's more density, people aren't as wealthy, more people of color. But then other people say we kind of like not having too much density because we moved to Hamden for a reason, right? We like to walk in our streets and not be crowded.
Those same people also want lower taxes. And, you know, I think that's a contradiction that if you pull the full arguments out in order to get lower taxes, I think we need to usher in some modest growth. So let's say our town is 61,000 people right now. How do we get to a place that is, you know, modestly 65,000 over the next five years, you know?
5 years, that's ambitious. You'd be one of the fastest growing place in the country.
Sure. Yeah, 5 years, 7 years, just a plan for growth needs to be put
in place. Right, because this census did not show much growth in him. It was kind of interesting because you have been growing before
that. Flatlined. Yeah, we were absolutely flatlined.
But 4,000 5 years, Peter, that would be, wow.
It would be a lot. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, maybe a little ahead of myself there. But I think we have to have these conversations, right? And you have to have
these conversations. So you're saying you want more, not just multi-use development, but you want to have more density.
Yeah.
Not
yeah,
high rises, but maybe mid rises.
But it's also important that it fits the neighborhood, you know. And this is not like a character argument of neighborhood, because if you talk to civic associations, I think they're actually open to the idea. They recognize the segregation in Hamden.
So, Peter, I don't mean to be like an old man. It's very condescending. Mm-hmm. You're going to get creamed.
Well,
I mean, all the nice liberals in Spring Glen, once you say you're going to let the place become more crowded black
too.
People, they're going to cream you.
I believe in what I'm saying, and I believe this is the right path forward. And to be fair, a lot of those people are on the DTC, and their vote's already decided. So, you know, I believe in this issue in housing. I feel strongly about it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think what I'm proposing is very radical.
What are you specifically proposing?
So mixed-use development, specifically next to Walgreens, and then also allowing for more mixed-use development in places like Westwoods. Mm-hmm. There's a drainage issue in Westwood, so you need to get proper sewer piping in there. And that has been the holdup in that area.
And you can't really bond in Hamden because of all your debt. But can you get American Rescue Act money for that?
So there is money you can borrow, but I would be more interested in putting this out to bid and having developers come in and
as part of a development project, have developers pay it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
As part of it. But is it city town owned land? Can you really put it out to bid?
You'd have to work with the owners, the landlords. But in the 2009 example, next to Walgreens, the owners were spurned by that process. They were spurned by the civic association, and to me that stifles growth. So we have to work on that.
But are you also talking about density or not? Are you talking about having more units per lot so that it can cost less and you can have different incomes and different races?
It depends on the area, I think. Like, there are places we can upzone and do better, right?
But you're not really talking about having more people living in Spring Glen, just having more commercial uses.
Yeah. And if you look at Spring Glen,
you're not really dealing with the historic, when people are talking about the redlining or the fact that it's so white. You're not dealing with
that. No, I think I am, because you have to increase the supply. And if you increase the supply, you'll have lower...
But are you talking about increasing the supply of housing?
Yes.
So I only heard mixed use.
Yes.
But does that include allowing more housing?
Yes.
So how would you do that?
So again, working with planning and zoning, working with developers to find the right type of development for our town, I think is important.
But are you talking about changing zoning to allow more units per acre, or
it depends on the area. It really does. I think it is important to fit the character of a neighborhood, and we need to have more robust conversations.
But you are for more density.
Yes, I am absolutely for more density.
Peter Sears for more density. He's running for mayor of Hamden.
Yep.
He's one of three candidates on the September 14th ballot. He earned the spot. He went out there and got petitions more than anybody else. Got more signatures, which was very impressive, including incumbent mayor, someone who's run before, and someone on the council did not get the signatures. It's not easy. Everybody thinks it's easy. It's not easy.
They made the process hard this year, too.
They've always made the process hard this year.
Well, they put the convention on the last date. So
so you have fewer days to get it, and that's just, it's always been like oligopoly, like, you know, the way it's always working. I mean, to register our voters by law has to be a Democrat or Republican, even if only one vote goes to Republican, right? Melissa Godservant says, bullseye. Thanks for listening, Melissa. So, Peter... We've talked about zoning. You say all politics should go back to being local, even if they're informed by a larger perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have a large perspective. You've been involved in politics, right? You've been in Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. You were a field organizer in Pennsylvania. You worked in the Boston State House. You worked for Chris Murphy. So would you define yourself as a progressive?
I don't think the labels are useful locally. Nationally... I always tell who I voted for. So 2016, voted for Hillary Clinton. 2020, I think in the primary, I was a big Yang guy, but he wasn't on the ballot in Connecticut. So I think I ended up voting for Bernie Sanders. But, you know, I have identified with what Joe Biden has done. I think.
Who's you going the general, Jill Stein? Oh, she wasn't on the ballot.
No, I voted for Biden.
Okay, I'm just teasing you.
Yeah. but I liked Yang. I thought he had a lot of good ideas. He was smart. You know, I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism, but I do think that we need a strong social safety net at the bottom to help the people that kind of get crushed by capitalism. And if we're not cognizant of that, we're going to leave a lot of people behind. You know, and that's what's been happening in America. You know, wealth goes to the top, and it's not being distributed back down. I do believe in capitalism. I think it's the most productive way to run a government. It finds the best efficiencies and has the best motivations, but there are negative externalities of that, right?
Okay. Daniel Hunt writes, he's a smart guy. I met him recently. He has a lot of great ideas that could move the town forward in a positive direction. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Daniel.
So, Peter, as you said, you'd like t- that what's more of a national issue than income inequality? What's more of a national issue than capitalism versus democratic socialism? So when you're talking about the safety net, you're talking about inequality. How does that translate to local issues in Hampton?
Yeah, so I look at tax equity, and I place this in we are the richest state in the nation, and we pay a 52 mil rate here in Hampton. We're in New Haven now, but a diverse working class community like Hampton pays a 52 mil rate. You know, for nothing, yes, there is some mismanagement, but for nothing more than paying our pensions and doing what we're supposed to be doing. And then if you look at Greenwich, their mill rate is 11. So I look at this in the context of Connecticut in our town. We are the working class backbone of this state, and we get crushed by our taxes. We have an unfair tax system here in our town, and we need to put pressure on the state to rectify that situation. I don't think we're going to tax and cut our way out of our budget deficit. You know, it's $1 billion. I think we have to be realistic about that.
Wait, $1 billion?
Of liabilities, right. Yeah. So we have to be realistic about that. We have to be realistic about the incoming fixed costs that are rising, right? And we're going to need state help to help rectify that situation, or else, you know, we're going to hit a cliff where taxes will go up because we have to hit a $30 million debt payment. And this year, we only paid about $22 million on that. So that's an $8 million gap that the current administration's plan is to increase it incrementally year by year to get to that. That means tax increases, right? That is
because you don't see easy things to cut.
Right.
You're saying get the state to give you the $8 million. So, Peter,
that is the long-term goal.
Yeah.
I think you have to deal with the reality of the situation, though. So I look at departments. A lot of them are administrative top heavy, you know, through years of patronage.
What would be examples of that? Because people always talk about that. What would be a top-heavy department?
So the Board of Education, specifically.
Talk about that. So what are specific jobs there that shouldn't be there?
I don't want to call out specific
jobs. But you got it, because I've covered elections for 40 years. I've always heard in every town, Board of Education is top-heavy, get rid of the fat. Yeah. I've never heard a single job named.
I just think my general philosophy is we need to get money to the classrooms. We need less.
No, everybody agrees with that. Yeah. But then you're getting a federal grant, and to get the federal grant, you have to monitor the federal grant. You're hiring teachers. You need someone who hires teachers. Mm-hmm. You need to have curriculum. You need to have a legal staff because you get sued.
Yep.
So soon you're having all these jobs that aren't in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So everybody looks at that and says, man, all our boards of eds, we spend all this money that doesn't go in the classroom. And it's a good point, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone running for office who doesn't have to make the decisions, and this isn't personal, nothing offense, says we got to cut the fat in the Board of Ed. I have never in my life gotten an answer from a candidate about a single position to be cut at the Board of Ed. Can you think of one?
Yeah,
you're confident exist.
I think we're in a budget crisis, so I think you have to look at the high school and the middle school and be like, can we have one less principal at each? Like, and you have to go.
So there's more than one principal or assistant principal?
Assistants.
Yeah, right. That's true. One thing, you're right. The one exception always gets assistant principal. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could save $120,000. Although they're for a reason and for two, right? Like if there's a lot of violence.
But, you know, to be fair, our Board of Education budget goes up every year. Mm-hmm. But enrollment in Hampton High School has been going down. So we're not actually, you know, in this year in the town council budget, they just approved a $500,000 increase because that's the politics of it. Yes, it's
and
good
cost
to
of living.
Right. But it's good to increase education budget because people like that, right? But the reality is there's less people in our schools, and we need to be cognizant of that because we're in a budget crisis.
Well, we just decided we were going to close two schools as a way to deal with a small enrollment, and it was just announced by the mayor yesterday. There's a deal that selling Wintergreen School will enable Church Street School, and what was the other one, to remain open?
Shepherd
Glen. So would you close the schools?
No, I don't think. So for me, the frustration here, this is the end of a three-year process that is incredibly grueling. Incredibly grueling on our town. And, you know, I really see the difference just being we got American Rescue money. Yes, we sold WIMS, but we could have done that sooner. Right. And so in the timing of this is suspicious to me. This has been held over people's heads for a very long time. We haven't gotten good answers. And we still don't have an answer on the middle school WIMS.
But if you want to deal with having a small, you want to save your $8 million largely by getting rid of fat at places like the Board of Ed and deal with the fact that you have fewer students so you don't need to raise a budget. How would you then not be for closing two school buildings so that you can save resources? Does that not really save resources?
I don't think that necessarily saves resources. Again, I think you have to look at enrollment of the high school too and think about distribution in that way. How do you tie it to metrics that are
so
real?
You gave an example of assistant principals, so you might be able to save some of that. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
No, I think just generally, we're going to do a full audit of every department, but just generally, my philosophy is less principals, more teachers, Right.
All right.
How do we get more money directly to classroom?
But you might want to keep English teachers, because they would tell you it's fewer principals, not less principals. Just joking. Yeah. Sorry, Peter, just joking around.
Yeah, thank you. As a journalist, I appreciate that.
Peter Sear is running for mayor of Hamden, one of three candidates on the Democratic mayoral primary ballot in a historic election. Has there ever been three before?
Ooh, good question. The last contested one was 2019, and then we had Henrici. So I don't think there was three, but
in the Democrat, yeah.
There's not really ever contested mayor elections here. You know, it's pretty. We go by a strong party system. You know, Democratic nominee.
I was just thinking, Peter, while the youngest candidate's got the most names on petitions to make the ballot, which I thought was a huge accomplishment. I've worked on petitioning myself back in the day. That's not easy.
So you know how it is.
You work for every signature. Yeah. Kevin Cooper laughing my ass off. I'm glad you're having a good time, Kevin. So lost. We have a lazy America problem. The government payouts just proved it. Okay, that maybe for another day. Garnett John, and thank you for listening. Would love to hear what Peter has to say about modeling Project Ceasefire, New Haven and Hamden. And then Irvin Pinsky and Daniel have more. Daniel talks about what's the public safety plan. We'll get to Irv's in a minute since Garnett and Daniel are on the same wavelength. So Project Ceasefire in New Haven, Hamden. I believe that's the one that's been called by other names, where the feds, the state, and the local police combine their intelligence efforts so they can bring federal charges that keep people in prison longer just for the most violent crimes. And they focus on the small number of people who are responsible for large percentage of shootings, of which we've seen a whole spate by the Hamden-New Haven line recently. And it was working pretty well until the pandemic when their call-ins were put on hold. They've started again. Okay, I've talked too much. What do you think about that? What's your plan for public safety?
I think this approach has to come outside of the police department. It's very important that it does, because in order to attract the people to the program that you need to reach, you can't slap the badge on it, right? So I think that is incredibly important. We need to fund this outside of the department. And essentially what Project Ceasefire is, it's like you're saying, you have to identify the people that are most likely to cause violence and try to find a way to meet them with services. Specifically, the most powerful conversations are you put people on the payroll that are moms, dads, best friends of victims of violence that want to be involved in this, and you have them do the outreach and you pay them to organize.
Okay, right? So I've gone to some of these call-ins. That's what they have. They bring the people in.
Yeah, the call-ins, right.
Now you do have law enforcement because they know who's who.
Yep.
And then they bring in, not on the payroll, they bring parents who have lost kids to violence and say, I lost my kid. Someone shot him. Please stop shooting. I don't want someone else to die. I'm a mom. They have the outreach workers who are people who sometimes were in the life, sometimes weren't before, who have credibility in the street, who are not cops. They always offer, you could either go to prison for a long time. Here's a picture we have of you committing this drug dealing crime, this violence crime. So we got you. Or we'll give you this option right over there. Talk to that person about job training, drug training, housing help. Never, almost, does anyone in the room take the social service help.
So I think it's about how you set up the program. Yes, it's hard to pull off. Yes, it's hard to do.
No one doubts you got to do it, because that's the just thing to do. You're showing you care.
You have to do it right, as
real people in the room, seeing the adults, seeing the victims. Yeah.
I think it's important because, okay, so you look at Oakland. In Oakland, from 2012 to 2018, is associated with a 50% reduction in gun violence, right? But they tried to do the same thing in Chicago, and they ran it through the police department. People didn't trust the program, and it didn't work, like you're saying. And I think when you see that when it doesn't work, it is because of that. It's too linked to the police department. It's not the trust isn't there because they know that all this information is going right back to the police. So I think it's about policing the big things, right, and making sure that we can stop the big instances of violence and maybe, you know, looking the other way on some other things, just so we get those people and we can make those connections. Right?
So that we've gone 180 degrees on that subject in America. Mm-hmm. Underlying all the police reform efforts of the 90s and early aughts was broken windows theory, which cut across left and right, by the way. The Heritage Foundation was in the room with the Drug Policy Foundation. And they said, if you want to get the big crimes, you can't turn your heads to the little crimes. Broken windows, they call it. If there's a broken window on a street, that's a signal that there's disorder, and the big crimes become little crimes become big crimes. Now, what's talked about, so now everyone's against that because in New York, they were doing stop and frisk, and if you're black, you're three times as likely to get stopped, and some little crime they stop you on where they really shouldn't, like a marijuana charge, they'll use that to lock you up for a long time. But what everyone has left out of that debate is that, yes, there was a New York broken windows that picked on people for little crimes. But there was also a New Haven broken windows approach, which was that they addressed the small crimes, but not by arresting people. So I remember going to the Hill once when a bunch of kids were harassing alcoholics on the street. And the cop noticed they were spending the days jumping on a beat-up old mattress. He got him a trampoline. And they knew the cops were watching, but, like, they engaged the kids. Or if someone, you know, kids see violence, you got to get them help with Yale Child Study psychologists who are working with the cops. So I'm wondering whether we're making a mistake by going all the way in the other direction and saying, don't address the quality of life small crimes. That, in fact, if you have disorder, those lead to bigger crimes. But that maybe we don't do it in the way we used to, where we criminalized behavior that need not be criminalized or addressed it with the wrong people.
I think it's about building trust. And you need to be able to have real candid conversations with people about why they're actually these shootings are happening. What a lot of them are linked to retaliation, right? So if an effective program has relationships with these people and they know when retaliation is going to happen, and you know, you have organizers that can reach out to these people that you think are going to commit this violence and go get coffee or something, you know.
And those are the violence intervention teams. This is now being embraced nationally. We had a great one in New Haven that Hamden has taken on. Kurt Lang has contracted with CTVIP. That's the Lynn Jihad's program, when you by Outlaw. So you're right. When they go to talk to someone, they are good about not telling the police certain information. But they work with the police, not violating trust to try to stop crimes and reach out to people. So if I'm not mistaken, you support one of these programs, crisis intervention teams, right?
I support funding programs outside of the police department.
And that would that have like have mental health workers come to a scene.
So this is different. So this again, I think is a long-term goal, is like we need to hire more professional social workers in local government. And you talk to anyone who's my age, 26.
But how do you get money for that?
Like I said, this is a long-term goal. So you know, we just had four police officers added to our force. I would rather than hire police officers, I'd rather hire professional social workers that can deal with homelessness. Because if you talk to cops too, they do not know how to deal with these issues.
Right. They always say we're not social workers.
Exactly.
That's another way.
You know?
So, but would you have fewer cops? I mean, people aren't calling for fewer cops now.
No, I think the number of 100 is good in Hamden. I think that's fair. You know, I think it's manageable. So I think our department is good as it stands. I wouldn't change more. I wouldn't add more. I wouldn't take away less. What I do think was frustrating is in the latest police union contracts, we have the no layoff clause.
People can't stand union contracts because they also protect cops who do wrong. Although most people who oppose union contracts tend to like unions in general because you think workers have protection.
Like, yeah,
the idea is that these police unions have gone so over the top that are across the country that cops who do horrible things to people are protected and kept on the force, or it's impossible to fire them. But what can you do as mayor? There's a reason, right, that all these Democratic mayors have not been, and Republican mayors have not been able to change that. So you'd come in if you're elected, got a 3-year contract, right?
Yep.
No layoff clause, and although I think people exaggerate sometimes that you do need some protections, innocent until proven guilty, even for a cop who does something wrong. But how would you address that as the mayor? How would you change that?
I have a commitment to negotiating out that no layoff clause. But I also have a commitment to working with the police on these reforms.
But can you revisit a contract that was signed?
No, I mean, it's going to have to be in the next one, right? But that is a commitment on my end that I want to hold our town to. I think in America, you should always, you know, there should be an option to get laid off. That's just especially in a fiscal crisis, you know, like we can't, the reason that our ballooning payments are what they are is because we have these contracts, right? And we're locked into these things. So I don't think that contract, the frustration was with the process. They threw it on the council in a night to decide. It did not go through the police commission. We have a police commission for a reason. We should be using them. You know, and also there was a huge...
I think the police commission probably would have passed that contract in a day.
Well, they didn't even review it, right?
Yeah. So that says something about the police commission, doesn't it?
I agree. I would like to empower them more. You know,
so you feel good about who's on the commission?
I do think we have good representation on the commission. I would add, there's only 5 people on it. I would add more to maybe include some more districts. But yeah, that's in the
reform. Correct. Irv Pinsky says, how can we get some of the great entities that are growing, fleeing or outgrowing? Sorry, I'm having a little trouble reading this one here. Back in town. So what do you do? I guess that's about economic growth, right?
Yeah, so I think currently right now Hamden is too retail.
Or outgrow. I'm sorry, he's saying the ones that are fleeing or outgrowing New York City. So how do you get those New York City outgrowth into Hamden?
We just have to be more friendly to the digital economy. Like, I think the lines of work and home are more blended nowadays. We're less.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, we have a lot of comments here. I'm sorry. Sorry, folks. We'll get to these. Okay.
We are less. We need to be less focused on retail dependence. Like, we have the Plaza in Hamden. In the world of Amazon, that's not a great business model, right? So we need to be focused on getting more digital economy businesses. And also, I think zoning, again, this is restrictive. Like, we have commercial in one space, home in another, but these lines are blurred nowadays. So we need our zoning to reflect that. And that's, I think, a good way to welcome in new business. Change the zoning laws, be a little more flexible in what you can do, and not be so stringent on you can only go here. And
I'm sorry we can't get to all these folks. I'm going to do my best. Daniel Hunt points out that Hamden PD has 15 vacancies. Would you fill them?
Well, I mean, I think they right now they kind of use the vacancies to fund the overtime and things like that. So I do think we do need more officers. I think we need more diverse workforce that's closer to the community. So, yeah, I would work on filling those. But that's a problem, right? Like, we budget for these officers and we don't fill the roles, right? So, you know, we need more oversight on that money, too.
And Chris Astley says, come on, good representation on the police commissions. That's kind of a hot button.
It is. But I mean, I think there's personalities involved in that and history involved in that. But when you look at the commission, there's district representation there. I would be in favor of adding more seats, which was in the charter revision. I don't think we've got a good
explanation. And you support the charter revision?
I do support the charter. I signed the document. I do support it. I supported the district representation. I supported the addition of the COO. And I've testified to the council about those things too.
One thing that kind of gets me as an outsider is everyone says you got to have more efficient government. And then Leng got beat up because he hired a talented person from New Haven to be both the city planner and the head of development. And people thought, well, that wasn't legal. He needs two separate staffs. Wouldn't that be the exact way of having more efficiently funded government?
Yeah, I'm fine with that move. I like that move. I think Eric Johnson's qualified.
Okay, and we're talking to Peter Sear, who's running for mayor in Hamden. Folks, there are three people running just in the primary, Democratic primary, September 14th. Get out there and vote, please. And then there'll be three in the general. There's an independent party candidate and a Republican party candidate. Hamden's where it's happening.
Yeah, in election 2021. There's a lot going on. But I think it speaks to how important this year is. You know, I think we've seen a lot of issues boil over, and we're ready for change in Hamden. People are hungry for it.
All right. And Peter, you said something really interesting to me both on the air and off the air. So you just talked about for development strategy, we shouldn't be so reliant on bricks and mortar retail that there's a digital economy we should be leaning into. And you said before on the air that you're less web focused, social media maybe specifically focused than a lot of others in Hamden, even though you're the young guy, right? Yeah. So you grew up where like you nursed on a bottle or naturally and you had a device probably in your hand or connected to you. I mean, you guys are digital natives. Everything is in virtual reality. Everything is on social media. But Hamden has the most toxic social media we see around here. People kind of live on it. And you told me that you're less focused on social media for your campaign. Tell me why that is.
I think social media takes a lot of energy and you're only speaking to a certain group of people. You know, this Pew research data lives in my head on who uses what social media platform. And, you know, a lot of our town is geared toward Facebook. But not everybody in our town is on Facebook. And I think
most people are. I mean, billions on the planet are, right?
It's true. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people in town. Hamden's an older town, too. Uh-huh. They're not on Facebook.
And if you're on Facebook, it doesn't mean you're living on Facebook.
Exactly.
Like, I don't see most things that are posted on Facebook
because
I don't live on Facebook.
You get the people's profiles that you click on, you know. So it's an echo chamber, and half the people like you, half the people hate you. But what it does is it's you use a lot of energy in posting and doing stuff online. When if you use more formal outlets, I think you reach more people.
Is that true? You can reach more numbers, or do you have better quality engagement?
It depends. I think you have to reach people in a multitude of ways. So I'm not like adverse. Like, I do have a presence online, but you know, I don't live online. I try not to like read comments of people. You know, because if you get bogged down in the comments, I think you lose sight of reality sometimes.
And then the other side, though, isn't it important to know what people are thinking, or do you sometimes think that seven people who are talking a lot and should be allowed to talk don't really represent what everybody in town thinks?
Well, you know, seven people is only seven votes, right? Mm-hmm. There's 52.
So how do you reach more people than online?
Door knocking is the best way to reach people. It's you got to meet people where they're at. You got to find ways, and you have to go out of your way to connect with people the way that they want to be connected with too. So mm-hmm. so a door knock might not be the best for someone because they might be an introvert, not come to the door. Maybe it's a text, right?
Okay.
I think it's a multitude of approaches. But recognizing that when you post on Facebook, you're not reaching everyone, and that as the head of a town, you have the duty to get the word out to everyone.
Veronica Mantias, thank you for listening. Hope I didn't mispronounce your name. Says, how are we going to acquire the land from the Olin Corporation? Tell us about that.
Olin is a huge issue for me. You know, we have in Northern Hamden, we have Sleeping Giant, we have Brooksvale. But in Southern Hamden, we don't really have that.
Are we talking here about off Putnam Ave?
So it's like
and Dixwell.
Under, yeah, it's off Putnam, under Treadwell Street. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's a huge 100-acre forest. This is one of the main things I talk to people on the doors about. You'd be so surprised how many people don't know that there's a 100-acre forest there. So there's a group that has, there's a lot of groups involved in this process, and they have a plan put forth. It's to acquire the land to turn it into hiking trails. There's some contamination and some
sites.
What's
it being used now for?
Nothing. Closed off to everybody.
Just closed off public access.
Olin Corporation owns it. They haven't let anyone in for 80 years.
Why would they get rid of it? Why do they want it?
So there's one site that has old battery waste in it. It's pretty concentrated though. We cannot use that part of the site. But there are sites that have been deemed safe for recreational hiking.
Where would you find the money, or would you ask them to donate?
It's really not that much money. And the ownership group probably would run through the Regional Water Authority. So mm-hmm. this is about making it an issue and finding out the best way to move forward.
Make it happen.
Yeah, and finding out the best way to move forward with Olin, right? I think some of the hang up from a lot of the people that have been involved is that they want Olin to remediate the site. The litigation is through on this. I don't think that they're going to remediate it anymore, and they're going to drag their feet until the first right of purchase comes up, which is in 2031. And they have no incentive to do this, right? So I'm interested in moving forward without Olin. I don't think we're going to get more from them. I think it's slowing down the process, and I want to get this open. This is something that we can do. It's something that would add.
How would you get remediation? Is there federal money for that? American Rescue Plan?
I think we have to work.
The answer to everything.
Yeah,
American Rescue
think,
Plan.
I think, no, it's actually, I think this is important. Olin, the reason, so at the state level, there's been a lot of brownfield money going out. But the reason that it did not come to Hamden is because Olin owns the property. They think that Olin is going to do more work on it. I just think that's a dead end for us. That's 10 more years of waiting. I don't think we could wait because I think we want to add the value.
So would Olin
give
it free if they don't have to clean up?
It's like $10,000.
Oh, okay.
It's like $100 an acre. It's really not that much.
Chris Ashley says, how about a civilian review board?
I would like to empower the police commission to have more powers closer to a civilian review board.
Now, is it true you said they don't have subpoena power? I thought all police commissions do.
Yeah, they do not have. They have the power to review cases of police misconduct, but they're not the final authority.
I meant subpoena power.
No,
because my issue in New Haven is the police commission has always had subpoena power.
Yeah, I would like them to review things like the police commission, the union contract, and I also would be open to have them reviewing misconduct and by a 2/3 vote, removing an officer on a misconduct.
But do you think
review.
That chairman would ever be up for disciplining a cop?
I think we have to have honest conversations about it. You know, okay. I really do. And if we and if they're in the interest of the department, and public relations, I think it's important to remove the bad apples. And for the most part, Hamden PD does a good job. They do good outreach. And I support the police. I want to make that clear because this is not an attack on the police. This is just a commitment to a better process that civilians can have a place to sort of an outlet, right? We don't have that. We need that tool in our town.
And it's true in New Haven, you know, we've gone through several iterations of civilian review because yeah. Instead of just making the police commission work right, because in the 1970s, 1977, the police commission in New Haven was the one that used subpoena power and unveiled the largest in the nation per capita illegal wiretapping operation run by a police department. Mm-hmm. And they got people fired. There was a civil case. And the police commission was able to do it because they had the tools, including subpoena power. And I always wonder why people don't talk about strengthening police commissions and getting the right people on them, mm-hmm. as opposed to duplicating it when people, it's hard to get them to meetings and they don't have as much power. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting issue. Daniel says, what's your plan for the Youth Service Bureau? They have a staff of 2. Plus, what initiatives does he have in store to engage with the youth?
Yeah, I think youth services are incredibly important. If you go talk to people in Southern Hamden, they think part of the reason the rise in crime is there's nothing for the youth to do. So I'm supportive of both funding nonprofits like The Village, giving them line items because I think of that as a
How
crime.
Did that turn political? Why is that political, the village?
It's
That's
a
the
real,
youth agency. We want these kids have
It's a really long story. I think they're doing great work at the village, and I think that is a program we should support. And whether it's at Monkey Joe's or a different location, I'm open to finding them a place to operate that's better than the building that they have right now.
All right. Peter Sear, 26 years old, running for mayor of Hamden. So much fun getting to know you. You really know a lot about politics, a lot about the issues. Let's talk about how you got there. You grew up in Hamden. You grew up in what neighborhood?
So I was on Brook Street until first grade, and then I moved to Spring Glen. My parents' house is the one right next to Best Video, mm-hmm. So right across the street.
Oh, so did you run over and get moves at the time? You didn't have to get them late. Did you go hear the music there?
Yeah, definitely. The music came a little later.
I know.
Yeah, but I lived in the political documentary section of Best Video. They have every political documentary from ever. I love it. I'm a political junkie, so I love that stuff. Yeah.
That's fun. So you grew up in Spring Glen. You went to public schools?
Yes, I went to Helen Street till first grade, Spring Glen, Hamden Middle. I was the first class in the new Hamden Middle School, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then
Boy,
Hamden
you've seen
High.
A lot of changes there. And all
Yeah. I was actually the product of a lot of incredible changes in Hamden. I was in the new Spring Glen School, the new Hamden Middle School, and then I went to Hamden High as well. And at Hamden High, I was offered a great selection of AP courses. I think I went to college with like 16 credits. So I believe in Hamden Public
Schools. My kids kind of did that too. We saved a lot of money.
It's a full semester. You know?
Melissa Grant Servant says, hearts for the village. Okay.
Yes.
So tell me what you learned from that experience of being I know Spring Glen, was that the open school without the walls and then nobody could hear?
Yes. So we had like my third grade class was like an open classroom with all the third grade classes in it teaching separately. Right. But then they
had to put the walls up, right? People couldn't hear.
Well, they built a whole new school.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like they took down the old one. I'm not sure. I don't know. That was a long time ago. I was in first grade. You know, I'm not sure the exact details on why they took down the old
school.
What
did you learn from your Hamden experience? What's a lesson you took from that could help you make a good decision as mayor about education in Hamden?
I think when you think of Hamden, you think of diversity. You could go and you could talk to anyone. I'm confident talking to anyone. I know how to identify with people from different backgrounds. And that's been a huge advantage. And if you come out of Hamden strong and you use the resources that are there, that's a huge advantage for you in life. And that's something that I found when I went to school in California. I found that I was way more comfortable in a lot of social situations because of that. And it's something that I think has made me a stronger person.
Anything else about the way schools run that you would change based on experiences you had?
My dad is a public school teacher in Waterbury.
Oh, yeah?
So I believe he actually just retired, but I believe in public education. And I think Hamden Public Schools does a good job with what we have. You know, it's not as much as other towns like Fairfield, but for what we have, we make a lot of it.
So you had the real life experience growing up in Hamden, going to the schools, living in the neighborhoods. Then you went to UC Berkeley.
Yes.
Where even for college students, you're especially in the clouds out there, right?
I think that's one way of looking at it. I think it's a big school. There's 25,000 people.
But you were in political science.
Yes, I was in political science.
Was everybody woke there?
You know, there's actually, it's not as like, so I think that narrative is from the 70s, the flower children, the Reagan.
Even when we visited
Park.
There a bunch of years ago, it still seemed like the commerce was pretty, yeah.
It's like the sort of, I characterize some of the homeless people there as like they choose to be homeless. They don't like conform to society and stuff. So you run into a lot of that like funky stuff, some tree people, you know. But I love Berkeley. Berkeley is a wild place. I had some incredible professors.
Tell me something you learned in political science there from a professor in a class or an experience that broaden your perspective and could be applied to your being the mayor of Hamden, Connecticut.
I think what Berkeley did a good job of teaching me is my place in the world and how I got to where I was. So what it meant to grow up in Hamden and how that is different than growing up in somewhere like Greenwich or Fairfield and what that means for me. And, you know, I feel incredibly lucky to have had the experiences that I've had. And I know that that is not the same for everyone in my town. And I want to hold our town to a commitment to give those same opportunities to everybody in all parts of our town.
So 2016, you were 21 years old.
Yes.
And you're out in Pennsylvania as a field organizer for Hillary Clinton.
Yep.
What did you learn from that experience? What that was like?
I learned a lot. That's one of the most formative experiences of my life. If you know anything about Wilkes-Barre.
I don't.
It's kind of a county that Trump eroded the white working class And it's sort of where Trump seeded where we seeded the most ground to Trump. So we got shellacked in that. I think Trump won our district 70-30. But for me, it was about, I was sort of thrown in right after the convention. So sort of the tail end of the race. And it was really
one thing when Hillary was really going south, really not picking where to visit and all that kind of stuff.
She didn't come to Wilkes-Barre.
She didn't understand.
And Bill Clinton was
identified as one of the spots in addition to Michigan and Wisconsin that the campaign lost? Although 70-30 is a pretty big margin. She wasn't going to turn that around.
Yeah. I think her message just didn't resonate with the people there. But back to what I learned.
Yeah, you said
I learned how to talk to people that don't want to hear from you. You know,
give me an example of a conversation.
Just in general, like I would go door knocking and you just have a lot more, you're with Hillary Clinton, slam the door in your face, right? Like people have like spit on her
Here's
office
21
windows.
Year old eyelistic Peter at the door. Hi, I want to talk to you about Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Slam.
Right? And you know, like you said, coming from Berkeley, you have a lot of ideas that are you know, more progressive about the world, and you go to Wilkes-Barre.
The exploited working class. Turns out doesn't want you there to save them, right?
And Wilkes-Barre is actually one of the most, like, people in Pennsylvania that grow up there, they stay there, so a lot of people don't leave. So it's like, they're very, like, sheltered there, too. So coming in, it's like, I'm sort of the outsider, too.
Yeah. So how'd you learn to deal with that?
It's really hard to. I think in 6 months, it's not easy. And that's something that's different in this race, in Hamden. You know, I'm from Hamden, so that you just have a natural level of more trust with someone that's from your town. And like you said, all politics is local, right? Like,
that's what they used to say. We're trying to figure out if that's still true.
I think it is. Cause you know, I mean, from this experience myself is I found I wasn't effective. I found I wasn't that good. In Wilkes-Barre, I found that I didn't speak to those people cause I'm not from there. And then you come to Hamden and it resonates that I went to Hamden High. It resonates that I grew up here and I care about this place, you know? So for me, that's the difference. I think I found that I need to shift my focus closer to home if I want to make the most change because that really is the base for change.
So working as legislative aide to State Rep John Zlotnick in Boston State House, you've otherwise been here. Mm-hmm. You're a regional organizing director for the Connecticut Democratic Party.
Yep.
You worked for Senator Chris Murphy as a lead organizer on his Fight Back Connecticut campaign. What was the Fight Back Connecticut campaign?
Yeah, so we were focused on party building throughout the state, organizing around issues. Generally,
what did that have to do with Murphy?
So his issues, you know, gun violence, healthcare, you know, climate change.
This wasn't on an election year. This was building the apparatus for people who could help you on other years.
Correct. I think
that's an interesting way to build around issues.
I love the model that Chris put in place. I think about this as forever organizing. You need to organize all the time. Because issues are happening all the time.
Gun violence, climate change, what was the third?
Healthcare.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Those are the biggest ones for us that we tried to organize voters around.
Forever organizing versus forever war.
Yeah, right.
So Murphy, we were talking about this. Murphy's got a bunch of young people who have then gone from working for him to held public office. And in fact, there's a state rep in Meriden who still works for him.
Hilda.
Yeah, Hilda. And then you got Santiago. And then you have who's running for state secretary of state now. And you had Sean Scanlon, who's now a state rep, who used to work for Murphy. You have Ben Florsheim, the mayor of Middletown. So you're trying to be part of the – is there something to that? Do you guys stay in touch? Is there part of being a Murphy mentee?
I think Chris attracts smart people that want to make changes. And I think everybody comes to the realization that, you know, the most effective way to make change is like, yes, you can make change in Chris's office. But, you know, there's also – you could also just run and help your own community, right? There's not like a creed we sign and go out.
You don't have
run.
Any kind of secret dinners at like Adriana's where you like put your fingers in blood and you go on the napkin, no?
No. I don't think I'd like to be involved in those kind of dinners.
But what I get from the people like Florsheim, Scanlon, I don't know, Hill, there's like this kind of, and you, a kind of very sincere earnestness that things are possible and you're young.
Because I mean, I think I take that from Chris too. I mean, you look at his story.
He was that kind of candidate. He looks younger than he is. When he ran, he like took Washington by storm when he got there. It was like the young, fresh face. And was embraced by the national media, seized the opportunity to push issues. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think he hires good people too that want to make real change. And it's a process to get to this point, right? And I think as you go through it, you realize that to be the most effective, you should probably throw your hat in the ring.
All right. And that's what you're doing. Before I let you go, Peter, how many votes do you need to win?
It's a good question. I say, there's three people. So, like, you imagine there's 5,200 voters last time. Maybe there's more, maybe there's not, but 2,200 probably. I'm very open about it. It's probably around that.
You think you're going with 2,200?
Yeah.
I mean, well, I guess that would be true for you because you're sort of the third player in there. So if you don't get many votes, then it's really going to be carved up two ways, right?
But yeah, I think I'm going to get a good amount of support. You know,
How many ones and twos have you identified so far?
I'd rather keep that to myself.
Oh, come on.
I think
you're the young open guy. Come on.
Yeah. I just think it's going to be about meeting the most people. We've hit all the numbers we wanted to hit so far, and it's going to be about taking it home in the last 10 days, because the last 10 days are actually the most important, because it's like this election's on Tuesday, right? Like, so that's an effective conversation.
This is so exciting talking to you guys running. I think this is a great campaign in Hamden this year.
I do too.
Three really committed, intelligent people running for the Democratic nomination for mayor. You're all different.
We are. There are differences.
And I think we just can't wait to see what happens. What's great is that we don't know. The reporters who feel like we know everything and act like the know-it-alls, we don't have a clue what's going to happen on September 14th. You're just going to have to tune in and find out.
Yeah.
Peter Sear, it was so nice meeting you. Thanks for coming on Dateline Hamden, on WNHH. Yeah. And come back.
Yep, I'll be back.
If you lose the primary, who are you going to back?
I don't know yet. I don't think we're gonna lose, but we'll see.
Oh, so you're not committed to endorsing the Democratic candidate in general?
I'm committed to winning the primary.
Ooh. Yeah. So are you on the ballot for November independent? No.
No, I'm committed to winning the primary.
So you might back an independent or Republican?
That's not what I said, but.
But this is unusual. So yeah. You're not committed to the Democratic candidate?
Well. I would need some commitments from them first. I think there needs to be conversations. I don't think those conversations have been happening yet.
Wow. Okay. And then also, thanks everyone for the comments. Daniel Hunt, nice answer. John Garnett says this was very informative. Peter sounds like a very qualified candidate.
Thank you.
All right. So thanks for joining us, Peter Sear. How do people find out more about you?
PeterForHamden.com.
Is that F-O-R or the number four?
F-O-R.
All right. PeterForHamden.com. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience, one of the great cross-border. Oh, and Melissa Godservant says, loves your views. Taking out with the Afro-Semitic Experience, a great New Haven-Hamden collaboration, playing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to fly with us free all day and all night at WNHH, Hamden and New Haven's home for community radio.